Let's open up to Luke chapter 14. That's our study this morning. We're in the Gospel of Luke, walking through it together. So if you don't have a Bible, you can raise your hand. One of the ushers will pass one to you. But let's open up to Luke chapter 14. In the passage last week, Jesus talked about how we're to make every effort to enter through the narrow door. And he didn't necessarily specify what those efforts are supposed to be directed toward. Just the warning there in the text was, many are going to try to enter, but it's going to be too late. The door's already going to be shut. So the point was simple. Make every effort possible to enter through that narrow door. But I think you might be left with a question, and I was left with a question. What are the efforts that align us with Jesus? What are those efforts toward entering through that narrow door? And of course, the entirety of the book of Luke and much of the New Testament deals with answering that question. You know, it's all laying out specifically what it means for us to live lives that pursue God and that pursue walking through the door that by grace Jesus has opened for us. So today's teaching is going to be no exception to that. We're looking at a passage where Jesus really criticizes the self-righteousness and the self-importance of the religious leaders, and all of this at a nice Sunday luncheon. So it's going to be a very polite and friendly Sunday luncheon. But let's read here together, starting in verse 1 of chapter 14 here in the book of Luke. It says, "One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. There in front of him was a man suffering from abnormal swelling of his body. Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?' But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, 'If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out?' And they had nothing to say." It's a great awkward luncheon already here. Verse 7, "When he noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, for a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited both of you will come and say to you, 'Give this person your seat.' Then humiliated, you'll have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, 'Friend, move up to a better place.' Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." Then Jesus said to his host, "When you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous." When one of those at the table with him heard him say this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed is the one who will eat the feast in the kingdom of God." Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to go and find those who were invited. 'Come, for everything is now prepared.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, 'I have just bought a field, and I must go and see it. Please excuse me.' Another said, 'I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me.'" We've all been there, right? We've all experienced that. "Still another said, 'I just got married, so I can't come.' The servant came back and reported all this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, 'Go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.' 'Sir,' the servant said, 'what you ordered has been done, but there is still room.' Then the master told his servant, 'Go out to the roads and country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house may be full. I tell you, no one of those who were invited will get a taste of my banquet.'" So are you guys hungry yet? We all this talking about feasting and banquets and luncheons. Oh my gosh, you know, I'm actually hungry. I was hungry first service, but now I'm really hungry after reading that so many times. And when it starts out, you know, the theme is all these different settings of eating and these luncheons and these banquets. But there's a lot of different teachings that I do think all really interrelate with each other. And when it all begins there in verse 1 of chapter 14, everyone is walking in to find their place. And there's this man who's sort of out of place. He's got abnormal swelling of his body. And that would probably mean that he is ceremonially unclean. which makes him out of place. And we can guess, we could venture to guess that he was planted there by either the host or the guests, these prominent religious leaders, to test Jesus, because Jesus has done this a few times throughout the book of Luke. He's healed individuals on the Sabbath. And we know that there's a level of scrutiny here that's going on because they're carefully watching him, as Luke writes in verse 1. So Jesus sets them up with a question before he actually heals the man. He asks them, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? And like I said, we've seen this before. I think it was a chapter ago or two, Jesus healed the bleeding woman on the Sabbath. And so he's obviously equal opportunity healer, both men and women. This has become a greatest hit for Jesus. So, he is going to do this thing, and he's setting up that scene. For those of you who've missed our previous studies, you may, be lost in where the conflict is here. But basically, the Sabbath is this commanded day of rest by God. And some of these religious leaders would see healing on the Sabbath as work, violating God's decree. A holy man shouldn't do that, and certainly not the Son of God. But Jesus does it anyway. And he says, look, if your child or your ox had fallen in a well, you would do the work to get them out. It wouldn't matter if it's the Sabbath day. So I hear him saying to these religious leaders, look, guys, if you had skin in the game, if this mattered to you personally or affected you personally, then you would do something about it. You'd do the compassionate thing. I think this is a pretty basic human principle, right? That we all do the compassionate thing when it involves us in some way. If my wife breaks down on the side of the road in her car, I'm going to do the compassionate thing. I'm going to cancel my meetings. I'm going to make sure I go out there and assist her. Or whether it's my brother or my sister or somebody in my family. Now, if it's you on the side of the road, I'm not going to do anything. And when I say you, I don't mean you personally, because I would definitely help you. But I mean you all, right? You masses, you crowd, right? We will help those who are directly related to us. But when you pass by somebody on the road, that's somebody's sister. That's somebody's wife. That's somebody's friend. That's somebody's family member. But it doesn't occur to us. You know, in the same way, when it comes to animals, we don't have oxen, so we've never had one fall in a well. But you guys have pets. You know, if your dog is running down the street, I'm going to be honest with you, I'm going to give it a healthy jog. I'm going to jog a little bit after that thing, and I'm going to be like, wait, all right, whatever, it's gone. You know, somebody else will find it. With my dog, okay, that's my dog, that's part of my family. I've got to chase after, I've got to sprint after that dog until I catch it. But actually, in my case, I probably wouldn't actually run after my dog. He's probably good, too. I might do the same thing. But the point is made, right? If it involves us, we will do the compassionate thing. And so Jesus basically is saying to these religious leaders, guys, you guys care about your religious self-image in front of others more than you care about the suffering of others. We think it's cold-hearted, right? We think, oh man, these guys are just in another world. They are so focused on themselves. I think we have a little self-righteousness and we just think, oh Jesus, you burned them, right? I mean, that these guys wouldn't celebrate this healing and that they just care about all their laws and spiritual practices. But I think we have some things in common with them. I mean, they're pursuing their own image. Think about how much money is spent on vanity in Orange County. How much money is spent on vanity in Orange County? Being vain, what we look like. And some people don't spend a lot of money, they spend a lot of time. That's another thing that's valuable, all focused toward vanity. And it's a major emphasis. I'd say probably half of our disposable income, is vanity, or maybe more. I mean, you can buy a shelter, or you can buy a fancy shelter that says something about you. You know, you can buy a car that drives around, or you can buy a nice car that says something about you. You can buy a shirt, or you can buy a shirt that says, I'm amazing, and I'm a beautiful person, right? So we always are making those decisions, and while we're making those decisions here in Orange County, we have the largest refugee crisis in modern history. 65 million people in the world today are refugees. 65 million. So that's more people displaced as a result of conflicts in the Middle East and Africa. More people displaced today than following World War II. So the most in all of modern history. And all the money that we spend on our vanity could be somebody's money for shelter. It could be somebody's meal. It could be somebody's medicine. But we have obligations, right? We have obligations. We have commitments to what? To our own image. So these religious leaders had obligations too to their own religious image. Jesus, on the other hand, can't think of anything that overrides the need to demonstrate compassion toward another person, not even the Sabbath law of God. Okay, it's a great start to a lunch, right? Great start to a party. And it's like, awkward silence, awkward silence. Jesus is the king of awkward silences. He loves them. Oh, be silent. Let's have an awkward pause for a moment. Just kind of hangs in the air for a minute. All right, let's find our seats. And so everybody's going to find their seats. And that's the way Luke writes it, right? It's just like, okay, now everybody's taking their seats. And Jesus is watching as they're elbowing over the greater seats. You see, in Jewish meals, there was a social kind of statement about where you are on the social ladder based on where you're sitting at the table. You know, those who are more distinguished guests would be closer to the host. And those who are less distinguished would be further away. So the times that they're together for these Jewish meals, not so much about the food. You know, they're not foodies like we are today. It's not so much about the relationships, at least in this meal and setting. It's all about what their seat at the table would say about them, or for the host, who is seated near them and how it distinguishes his own greatness. So these guys are elbowing for those higher seats. Now, what is our modern analogy for this? Because I can see that there's some clear self-promotion here, self-interestedness, some pride on the part of the Pharisees, these religious leaders. What is our modern analogy? I mean, it's kind of hard for us to draw a cultural parallel because that's not how our tables work, right, in our house. It's not how church works. It's not like we have these seats up front labeled awesome. If you think you're awesome, sit here. And if you're less awesome, sit in the back. You know, we don't have that to see like where people would assign themselves. And people in the back are like, amen, right? There's nothing wrong with me for being back here. I'm not less awesome. So the only thing I can think of is social media. I think social media is a great example as we consider self-promotion. You know, it's a modern thing. People did not do this for centuries, where they take pictures of themselves at arm's length and then show everyone what they look like at arm's length. Selfies. You know, people take selfies all the time, right? And if you go on someone's phone, the most embarrassing thing is you look at their photos and they have like 100 shots they took to get the one shot that they posted online. Am I right? And you know, you don't just see self-promotion in selfies or in, you know, appreciating what you look like on as far as your face. You see pictures of people's homes. You see pictures of people's possessions. You see pictures of people's experiences. You know, social media is rarely about society and others. Have you noticed that? I'm campaigning that we stop calling it social media. We start calling it selfish media. Because it's mostly about me. We all have our own accounts, and my account is about me, and it only becomes social when you start liking my stuff and talking to me. You know, that's what we're all looking for. So there's a clear pull toward self-promotion. And I think we become fixated with our own image. And who was it in Greek mythology who was captivated by their own image? Narcissists. All right. Yes, we have a couple people remembering back your high school literature classes. Narcissists. Narcissus is this Greek character who looks in a pool of water, is actually led there, and becomes captured with his own image to the point he loses the will to live, and he dies there. And so he forms the root of this word, this psychological state that we have in our world today called narcissism. And now, would you believe... You know, I did some research. Would you believe that studies demonstrate that narcissism is on the rise? Gasp, right? No. Narcissism on the rise? I've got a newsflash for you guys. I did some research, and studies conclusively show that narcissism is on the rise. And it's not just, you know, people who take selfies on Instagram. You're frantically deleting them all, right? Because everybody's going to check your accounts when you get home. Narcissism, a simple definition of it, is an individual who's geared toward extreme selfishness. They have a grandiose view of their own talents and a craving for admiration. I think it's a good description of these religious leaders who would only break from their religious image if it served them in some way. They're asserting themselves to seats of honor. Would you say they're selfish? Would you say they have grandiose aspirations? Are they craving admiration? Now, when I said I did some research, I found no less than 9 contemporary studies that are all demonstrating the same trend in our culture, that narcissism is becoming commonplace, more widespread. And in these studies, they were measuring some related traits to narcissism. And what they found is narcissists have unrealistic expectations. They are materialistic. Orange County. They have low empathy. They have high self-esteem. They have a high self-focus. They have less concern for others, less interest in helping the environment, and they choose more unique names for their children. You're laughing, right? Because you know that's you. Orange County, that's all of us. And I've decided to share with you guys the names of my 2 identical girl twins that are going to be born, Mary and Mary. Because I just want to be a humble guy, but when we hear about these traits associated with narcissism, when you think about unrealistic expectations of others, when you think about materialism and hoarding stuff for ourselves, when you think about low empathy, the inability to feel for other people, high self-esteem, high self-focus, less concern for others, what do you hear but a people who are trapped within themselves? It's almost like they're locked in a prison of me, myself, and I. Now, I think the most interesting trait that's linked with narcissism that these studies show is self-esteem. That's kind of the shocker. That's the great reversal in these modern studies. A lot of people thought that narcissists are secretly lacking self-esteem, so they're compensating for a poor self-image that they have. But we found out that's just what they want you to think, so that you affirm them even more. Because it turns out narcissists really do think they're as awesome as they're promoting to everybody else. It's like these Pharisees deserving the seats of honor. They're looking at the seats and they have high self-esteem. They're thinking they're worthy of the higher seats of honor over and above everybody else in the room. And it's a common trait in our society. I've talked about it before. I think it was on my Easter message, right? Everybody in our society will honor themselves with the title that they are a good person. Everybody thinks they're a good person. What's the evidence of that? They have a general politeness, and they give a couple bucks away to a good cause a couple times a year. And guess what? I can award myself the seat of honor. I'm a good person, a great person. If I went before the Almighty God of the universe, certainly I'm getting into heaven for my politeness. That is us asserting ourselves in our own self-esteem. It's something we've cultivated in our culture. I mean, think about it. You've either said it as a parent to your kids, or you heard it as a child. What's a phrase that you heard that would cultivate your self-esteem? Son, you can be anything you want to be. Just believe in yourself. Ah, you ever heard that? You ever said that? You can be anything you want to be. Just believe in yourself. You know, I could say this to Isla. You know, Isla, my daughter, I want to cultivate esteem in you. I don't want you to be sheepish. You can do anything you want in life. Just believe in yourself. But you'll never be a tooth model because you suck your thumb and your teeth are going like this. But besides that, everything else is fair game. Just believe. My parents never taught me this. Okay, I can remember doing, you know, batting practice back when I was younger. You know, and it's whiffing practice for me. And I would just whiff, you know, and my dad's like throwing me the pitches, you know. It's just like, oh, you know, and what am I supposed to do here? Oh, Andrew, remember, it's all about believing in yourself. Believe that you can hit the ball, that you will have good hand-eye coordination, and it will arrive, you know, as a talent within your heart. So I got to believe in myself. That's what the inspirational speaker told me in elementary school. So I'm believing in myself. Throw the pitch, Dad. Whiff. All right, this doesn't work. You know, I can't do this. And my dad's like, son, you can't do this. You can't do this. Like, and I thank my father for giving up. Because it saved me so much time. It saved me so much time, right? See, we're cultivating a false self-esteem that isn't related to reality, which is just propping ourselves up in our own mind. And it's not just with children. This is developmental even with adults. We have religions based on it practically. Remember the book The Secret came out? It's not really a secret. It's just New Age principles repackaged in a different brand name to make more money. But it's basically just the law of attraction. And a lot of motivational speakers will give you this same piece of advice. Oh, you just need to change your thinking. If you just change your thinking and you imagine who you want to be, you will become that person. It's the law of attraction. If there are things you want to have, imagine those things and you will acquire those possessions. It's brilliant, right? Just create your own reality and that reality will be created around you. Just like the Pharisees. Just like these religious leaders at this dinner. They had created their own reality in their mind of how great they were, and they made that reality their reality. They sat in the seats of honor. But what they neglected is that there's a host hosting the meal that has true authority. And he holds the cards to objective reality. And he knows that they're not the most honored guest at the party. In fact, they're the least honored. So he has to share with them that all the secrets they've been telling themselves about their own greatness are just lies. And he has them stand up and, humiliated in front of everyone, they have to take the lowest seat. Because those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Self-esteem may be the great pursuit of American self-interest. And a lot of times, it's also one of the greatest pursuits of our Christian subculture. This is the water we're swimming in, and I think you see a lot of preaching geared toward raising the self-esteem of us as individuals. But for the host, Jesus, he would say the chief pursuit of self, and this is what he demonstrated, the chief pursuit of self is humility. Humility, not self-esteem, humility. Because it helps us escape from the prison of me, myself, and I. Army Staff Sergeant Salvatore Guenta was the first living Medal of Honor recipient from the conflicts of Iraq and Afghanistan. So he was ambushed with his squad and they were split up, and he actually went out into enemy fire to retrieve a fallen comrade and bring him back behind the lines. And then later, when two insurgents were taking one of the soldiers, his fellow soldiers, he ran after them into the line of fire and then brought the soldier back and provided medical care until the other soldiers returned to them. So at the ceremony when he received the Medal of Honor, he was quoted as saying, "In this job, I am only mediocre. I'm average. This was the situation that we were put into. I was just one brushstroke in that picture, and everyone else was one brushstroke in that picture. The medal should go to the guy on the right of me and the guy on the left of me. We were all in the fight. If I'm a hero, then every man that stands around me, every woman in the military, everyone who goes into the unknown is a hero." That man is humble. That man is also rare. What is your automatic response as you hear him describe his own role? How do you feel toward him as he describes his own role? I think there is an instinctive lifting that happens in our heart when we go, "Oh my gosh, the guy is a war hero, plus he's humble. Whoa," you know, we exalt him instantly, right? We want to honor him more. See, God is the same way. God is not looking to honor people who honor themselves in the dinner party called life. He's looking for those who don't spend their time assuming honor for themselves. It isn't about becoming someone with low self-esteem, because I know we always jump to extremes. "Oh, you don't want me to feel good about myself, so now I got to just feel awful about myself. Is that what you're suggesting?" No. Like the staff sergeant's example, it's about using our mind space and our heart space to esteem others rather than ourselves. We just think about ourselves less. Which is why Jesus teaches us not just to take the low seat. He says, "I want you to go around esteeming others because it gets you out of yourself. I want you to invite lowly people to your table so you show real generosity." Because this is the kicker. If you just invite your friends and your family and your rich neighbors, right? The people who are a little bit higher on the social ladder, you're not really being generous. You're not really a charitable person. You're just being nice to the people who are nice to you. It's an even exchange. It's about magnifying you still. You know, it's just like you'd pull your kid out of a pit. You'd pull your oxen out of a pit. It's about you. So invite the lowly, the blind, the crippled, the lame, the poor. And guess what? They can't pay you back. You become indebted from God. God will pay you what these people can't pay you. Well, some of you have been Christians a long time, and you've read the Bible front and back. And a lot of us would claim to be disciples of Jesus, walking with him, and we say his teachings are authoritative, and here's an authoritative teaching. When you give a luncheon, these are the sort of people that I want you to be around. Now, I know life's crazy in Orange County. We're carting the kids around to 8 sports. We are, you know, trying to sneak in a date night. We're in life group and all that other stuff, right, with church. We stay late at work, but we have to have some times where we're in community with other people. When is the last time you shared a meal with a crippled person? Just straight from Jesus' teaching. When's the last time you shared a table with a crippled person? When's the last time you invited over that unkempt person from your condo complex? You know, that really disheveled person? When's the last time they dined with you? When's the last time you invited over that coworker from work who gets really in your face and spits on you when he talks, and no one wants to be around that person? Right? When's the last time that person shared a table with you? We feel a motivation mostly that just goes in line with what Jesus is warning about, right? We have a pull to surround ourselves with people who can elevate our status, who can offer us something. Those are the kind of people that we give our attention to, right? Anybody just walks up from the masses or at work and they're talking to you and you don't consider them valuable for raising your status, and there can be kind of this like, yeah. You know, you don't even really give them your attention, but somebody important, the boss, somebody who can give you a promotion, you know, they have esteem. You're like sitting on their every word, right? Oh, what'd you say? Oh yeah, I totally agree, right? Those are the people we give attention to. Those are the people we want to rub shoulders with. Those are the people we want to be in life group with in the church, right? Oh, I think so many of us are looking for the in circle in every social scene we're a part of. What's the in circle of married couples? Where's the in circle of singles that are hanging out together and doing fun stuff on a Friday night? Where's the in circle of moms, you know, the moms group? What's the moms group that I want to be a part of? Everybody is looking to elevate themselves through their social relationships. I even see this in pastors on social media. You pull up a pastor's Instagram account, I guarantee you, half of the photos are selfies with a famous celebrity. Because hanging out with a famous celebrity is going to prop them up higher as a spiritual leader in America. You know, that's an odd thing. But to think, oh, I'm going to be cooler, I'm going to be better by association. I bet you Taylor Swift's boyfriend, who went to the prom with her in high school, still has that picture as his profile picture on Facebook. I guarantee you that's still the coolest thing he's ever done, and he's still trying to use it for his advantage. Jesus says, you got to hear me. Because we got, I can't say, because you're not cool if you call yourself cool. But there's some things about us, right? I think we want to be relevant. We got a youthful feel. My jeans are skinnier than most jeans. You know, that kind of stuff. Like, that some people, you know, you guys also criticize me left and right. Especially you older guys. I love that. Keep me humble. But I think, you know, we can kind of get this feel for all of our lives, especially in Orange County, that the pursuit, even within Christian circles, is coolness. That there's still a thing that's cool. There's still a thing that's exclusive. There's still a thing that's special that can elevate us socially. And Jesus, time and time again, says there is no such thing in the kingdom of God. There is no such thing as cool. There's no such thing as in. There's no such thing as exclusive in the kingdom of God. It does not exist. And for you, you might say, amen, I've been waiting for someone to say that. I'm so sick of everybody climbing these social ladders and trying to be on the inside. But, you know, are you someone who's inviting in the rejected? Are you somebody who's inviting into your life the lowly? Because I think we got a lot of people who tried to be cool in high school, couldn't get there, then got frustrated they couldn't get there, so they got a cloistered lifestyle where they're just as closed off to the needy as anybody climbing a social ladder. Are we inclusive? Are we inviting in the lowly? In the final portion of the passage we've been studying, we find that God does the things he's asking for. He humbles himself. He associates with the lowly. When he sends out his invites to the great feast and some rejected, he sends his servants to bring in the lame, the blind, the poor. All the people he just said we're supposed to be hanging out with. But there's still room in the feast. So he sends the servants to go invite people on the country roads, strangers, travelers, so that his table can be full. This is the feast of God, and he values every guest. You know, in contrast to last week, this is a great compliment. It's a narrow door that we have to enter through, like we heard last week, but God is eager to see many, many people pass through it. People like you and me. Not because we're important, not because we deserve a seat, but because he is generous and he loves to include people at his table. Now, do you see a theme in those who rejected the invitation to the feast? Don't you see not only the variety of excuses that they give, which are, we can laugh at it, oh, you know, oxen, I don't try out the oxen. But basically, if you look at all the excuses, it's all of our major obligations in life that we would come up with. Property, possessions, and family. Very typical excuses. A lot of excuses that we ourselves could have. But I look at it and I see one thing that's a theme there. The repetition of the pronoun I. I can't come because I have, I need, I'm going to, I, me, myself, and I. So they miss the invitation and they miss the feast. We live in a me world, just like the religious leaders. They'd only sacrifice their image if it benefited them in some way. They fought for the seats of honor. They wouldn't be caught dead at a dinner party with people who were beneath them. And that me-first narcissism meant that they missed the invitation of God to the ultimate feast because they were trapped in that prison of me, myself, and I. Jesus calls us instead to do what he first did, to set aside our image, to show compassion to a stranger. You just heard two opportunities this morning. Common Ground Surf Camp, foster youth, kids 6 to 12 years old. They will offer you nothing as far as your aspirations and goals for your personal life. They can offer you nothing. But the compassion of Jesus says, I'm putting aside my goals to show compassion to a stranger. He allowed others to take the seats of honor by esteeming them above himself, and he invites us to do the same. He tells us, invite the poor, the lame, the blind to be your company, and fill your lives with people who can offer you nothing. Then you'll be free from the prison of me, myself, and I. Let me give you some honest thoughts as we think about this. I think this is very, very difficult. Very, very challenging. And it's kind of sad that it's so hard for us to get outside of ourselves and do something like what Jesus is commanding when this is the very basis of the gospel message. Jesus is inviting us into something that he did. God condescends to earth and is among us. And he's going to redeem us, invite us to a feast, and we can't bring him anything? You know, so we benefit from this characteristic of God, and yet we lack it. We lack it. Most of us lack it, and we would call ourselves disciples of Jesus for years and years and years. It shows us just how much further we have to walk. But it's not just something that we benefit from in terms of our eternal perspective. I would say that most evils and excesses in the world stem from people being too inflated with themselves. That's how they can commit such atrocities. But then on the other side, much of our depression and anxiety, our paralysis, is also fueled by an overinflated sense and view of self. We're trapped in ourselves. We need the Spirit of God to break us free. To break us free. I need the Spirit of God. So let's go in prayer. Let's go in prayer and receive this invitation that brings life.